This is the second day of this March-April 2019 seven-day session. We'll resume reading about Bankei, the 17th century Japanese Zen master Bankei, starting with the first of our two sources, a book called The Unborn, The Life and Teaching of Zen Master Bankei, translated with an introduction by Norman Waddell. We left off yesterday with his profound enlightenment experience that capped off 14 years of incredible hardship. When people hear stories like this, of such terrible pain and exertion, they sometimes think, or even ask me in Doksan, do I have to go through that to come to awakening? Well, Bankei had to go through that. We can always look back on our path, our journey, with the understanding that we needed to go through what we did. That's the wisdom of hindsight. We needed somehow, he needed to do this. His story is remarkable in the degree of pain he went through. So many stories of the so many masters in their stories tell of hardship. Our hardship, the willingness to go through terrible suffering out of desperation to know. As long as one is asking that, will I have to go through that, or is that the kind of thing that is required of me, then one is not really engaged with one's own practice. You're just comparing, looking at someone else. As we'll read in his Dharma talks, he felt afterward that no one should have to go through that. And we'll hear more about that. But here's where we left off. After 14 years of incredible hardship, he had achieved a decisive enlightenment, his doubts and uncertainties disappearing like a dream. Or like his thoughts. Doubts are thoughts. Doubts can rear their heads at any point in Sesshin. Later, when they happen later in Sesshin, they can be especially challenging because they can seem so real. But whenever they arise, whatever the doubt is, it's a thought. Don't be deceived. So his doubts, his uncertainties, that's all wrapped around the notion of a self and its inabilities or inadequacies, they all disappeared like a dream. His strength returned, his appetite improved, and his health did too. I'm going to be skipping around quite a bit. These are two full books about Bankei and his teaching, so I've tried to just be selective here. He seems, we're still reading from the introduction to the Waddell book, he seems to have spent the next year or so in small hermitages built in the forested hills. This we could call the post-enlightenment phase of his training. And in 1650, it says, he apparently gave a lot of thought to the course his future teaching activity should take. He contemplated, quote, the natural capacity of my fellow men and the means by which they could be instructed in the way, trying to decide upon how best to transmit to others the understanding he had achieved. This is part of the story of the Buddha's own enlightenment, where after his great, great supreme enlightenment, he questioned whether this lofty teaching, this teaching that's a no-teaching, this transparent, this open secret, how anyone could arrive at it, or how many could ever do it. And he decided to, lucky for us, he stood up from his Bodhi seat and he went about spending the rest of his life relating what he had realized, the Dharma. And Bhanke seems to have reached the same point here, is how to reach people. That's the all-important matter of the means, the skillful means. It's one thing to have the insight, but then it's crucial as to how to share it with others so that they can understand it, which varies with the person, with the people, with the time, with the culture. And then word reached him of a Chinese monk by the name of Dosha, who had just arrived from China and was residing in Nagasaki. Umpo, remember him from yesterday, that was Bhanke's first Zen teacher, he suggested that Bhanke go to Nagasaki and see what this Chinese monk had to offer. Bhanke was still eager to find someone to confirm his enlightenment, and so he went off almost immediately. He traveled by water, begging a ride on one of the small trading vessels that plied the inland sea. And within a week, he was in Nagasaki. During their first meeting, Dosha confirmed Bhanke's enlightenment. He said, "You have penetrated through to the matter of the self." But then he said, "But you still have to clarify the matter beyond, which is the essence of our school." There's a footnote here. According to another account, the exact words Dosha spoke at this time were, "You have penetrated through to the matter of the self, but you have not yet clarified discriminatory wisdom." So, to restate that, if that's what he said, what he would have meant was, yes, you've seen into the absolute indivisibility of all things. You've seen into the emptiness of all things, the no-thingness of things, the emptiness of all phenomena. But you haven't yet integrated that realization of the oneness or the emptiness into the world of differentiation. But now to Bhanke, who was brimming with self-confidence, this was inconceivable, that he could have, it could be in any way, there could be any deficit in his realization. So he refused at first to accept Dosha's assessment and told him that. According to an account found in Dosha's recorded sayings, Bhanke looked at Dosha, laughed loudly, and then stalked brusquely out of the room without even making his bows. Sounds like a koan in the Blue Cliff record where Deshan, fresh out of his enlightenment when his teacher had blown out the candle, he stalked into the room where the Zen master Isan was sitting and proclaimed, "Nothing, nothing, shook his sleeves, and strode out of the room. This is such a contradiction that after having seen the illusory, clearly seen the illusory nature of the self, to still have this pride, it is a pride, sometimes called the stink of Zen. So it's illogical, just as it's illogical, if this is true, that sometimes when you've cut off the head of a chicken, it continues scampering around the yard for just a few seconds before collapsing. How can it keep doing that? Well, just habit force, some wiring that has kind of a life of its own, and that's what it can in cases like this, with Bankei. But it says, still, he did not leave the temple. There. Okay. Instead, he stayed on for a few days, and he closely observed dosha and the way in which he instructed the monks. And then it says, Bankei soon realized dosha's true merit. So he made up his mind to continue his practice with him. That is a sign of a truly remarkable master, a master of masters, that he didn't settle for that. He realized that he still did have further to go. So then in the months that followed, he went back to Dosha's quarters again and again. Dosha, remember, from China, did not know Japanese, and Bankei could not speak Chinese, although he could read and write it. So they had to communicate by means of exchanging written notes in Chinese, that is, the characters. Instead of speaking, they wrote and passed notes back and forth in Chinese characters. The saying for that kind of communication, called Hitsudan, is communicating with brushes in place of mouths and eyes in place of ears. Bankei, to his credit, took his place in the assembly of monks and lived with the others. But he was unwilling to follow some of the customs of the temple, whose regulations were patterned on those in Ming Chinese monasteries. He was particularly averse to the practice of chanting sutras in Chinese, foreign language. Reminds me of Roshi Kaplow's coming to loggerheads with Yasutani Roshi about whether the Prajnaparamita should be translated into English, just as it had been translated into every other language of the country where it was adopted. The following year, while sitting in the darkness of the Zendo with the other monks, Bankei had another enlightenment experience. He left the hall, rushed to Dosha's chambers, took up a brush, and wrote this question: what is the ultimate matter of Zen? Dosha replied, whose matter? Bankei extended his arms out. Dosha took up his brush. Before he could write anything, Bankei grabbed it out of his hand and threw it to the floor. He then swung his sleeves and left. The next morning, Dosha told the head monk that Bankei has completed the great matter. He directed him to move Bankei to the position of head monk, But Bankei declined this honor. He preferred his old place near the kitchen, and he continued doing his chores just as before, stoking the kitchen fires with fuel and serving the other monks their meals. Again, his uncommon willingness to not claim what could have, was rightfully, he could have claimed that lead position. And now we get into the real lives of monks. We've read these kind of stories and other accounts. Some of the monks seem to have resented Bankei's presence almost from the start. Certainly because of his independent attitude, what they took to be an expression of disrespect toward their teacher. But whatever it was, maybe that and other things, when they learned that this master Dosha had acknowledged Bankei's enlightenment, the undercurrent of resentment erupted into strong feelings of jealousy. As soon as Dosha got wind of this, he called Bankei to him in secret and asked him to leave the temple for a while until matters cooled down to avoid an incident with the others. And here we see, this is kind of a same song, second verse from the sixth patriarch, Wei Nung, having been advised by the fifth patriarch to flee the temple because he was so young when the fifth patriarch had confirmed his enlightenment that the other monks were jealous. There's a real enmity toward the sixth patriarch. Same thing here. It's just a reminder that monasteries and Zen centers and temples, these are places where a lot of people are still carrying around a lot of baggage. The Sangha is not some realm of pure beings. We are all still working on our afflictions, and sometimes they get the better of us. But with daily sitting, especially punctuated by Sesshin, we have the ability to forgive one another, to make allowances, to let go of what would otherwise be resentments that would build up. Except seeing these monks took them a little too long. So Bankei did leave. He went to some inaccessible part of Japan, which had been a favorite haunt of the mountain ascetics of esoteric Buddhism. He practiced in a solitary hut. And then he went back to his old hermitage after 5 years' absence, working hard to deepen his enlightenment still further. This may still be baffling to people who hear about enlightenment at such a depth that they're still working beyond that. But it's not if you consider that nothing deepens our faith, strengthens, builds our faith more than awakening to our original nature. And once we've awoken to that, then becomes harder and harder to settle for not being able to live fully out of it. just as completing a sesshin, especially a seven-day sesshin, leaves us with our faith deeper, you can imagine what awakening, confirming the truth of this Buddha nature, what that would do for our faith. And then it's even becomes harder to tolerate the ways in which we're not living out of that Buddha nature, the ways that we still give way to these afflictions. In Buddhism, there is the idea of three kinds, three levels or grades of afflictions. The gross afflictions are the absolute worst. Maybe the first violating the first precept of killing, or fill in the blank, other really terrible kinds of things. The second level are the lighter afflictions that we all still face. And the third is what are called the latent afflictions. These are the most chilling. Latent afflictions are afflictions that lie dormant under normal circumstances, sometimes for whole long stretches of time, until reaches a certain threshold of stress, and then they burst out. Under the right causes and conditions, or the wrong causes and conditions, then we can suddenly be shocked at things that we do, say, or do. I'm going to just go right to account of his death. Several months prior to his death, he stopped taking food. He refused all medicines. Says he spent the time speaking pleasantly with his disciples. On the day of his death, he gave some of them final instructions. And when he saw signs of sadness in some of them, he said, "How do you expect to see me if you look at me in terms of birth and death?" Someone asked if he would compose a death verse, which was traditional in the Zen school. He replied, "I've lived for 72 years. I've been teaching people for 45. What I've been telling you and others every day during that time is all my death verse. I'm not going to make another one now before I die just because everyone else does it." This is the kind of iconoclastic independence that he showed all through his life. And then after speaking those words, he passed away. He was in a seated position. According to one account, he was in a seated position, and on the other account, he was lying on his right side like the Buddha. Now we're going to switch to our other text, a book called Bankei Zen by Peter Haskell. That is, he put it together and translated it, I suppose. It doesn't say in the cover. This is translations from the record of Bankei. I skipped over the part where more and more and more and more monks and other people, lay people, came to train under him. But we'll get into that now. We'll start with the the Dharma talks of Zen Master. It says sermons. That's a bad translation. We don't use that word. Let's call them Dharma talks or teishos of Zen Master Bankei. And first, it sets the context, sets the stage. This was at a training period, a 3-month training period at this big monastery, attended by nearly 1,700 monks of every sect. So not just Zen monks, but others, some of them traveling hundreds of miles. It says available space in the zendo was quickly exhausted, and temporary sitting had to be improvised to accommodate the flood of new arrivals. This retreat was funded and provisioned by the Sasaki brothers. But the crowd of monks grew so immense that the Sasakis panicked and vainly begged Bankei to turn away any further applicants. During this training period, Bankei delivered a total of 60 talks, many of which were recorded by members of the audience. And these, together with some other lectures, constitute the bulk of Bankei's surviving talks and this book. So this book was drawn from the written records of that 90-day retreat. And then we continue. At that time, the master mounted the lecture seat and addressed the assembly of monks and laymen and said, "We've got a big crowd of both monks and laymen here at this meeting, and I thought I'd tell you about how, when I was young, I struck on the realization that the mind is unborn." This part about the mind, though, is something secondary. You monks, when you abide only in the unborn, will find that in the unborn, there's nothing anyone needs to tell you, nothing you need to hear. Because the Buddha mind is unborn and marvelously illuminating, it gets easily turned into whatever comes along. So as long as I'm telling the lay people here not to change themselves into these different things that come their way and trade their Buddha mind for thoughts, you monks might as well listen too. As if there would be any difference in that in terms of practice. Now let's address what this unborn is. As I said yesterday, he didn't invent this word. Actually, in the old Buddhist texts, hundreds of years earlier, that the phrase is used. The unborn, the uncreated, the unoriginated. Perhaps the most important thing is to understand is how we access this unborn, and that is through deep absorption in our practice to the point of samadhi. In fact, that is one rough way to understand the unborn, that in a true samadhi, and some people use that word too casually, in a true samadhi, there is no such thing as coming or going, birth or death, change. There's no time. It's You could say the unborn is the realm of the eternal. And we experience that through a samadhi, which is within the reach of everyone here. A breath samadhi, a mu samadhi, another kind of koan samadhi. We all have the ability to see, to experience what is beyond thoughts and other phenomena, mental and physical phenomena. This is what Bhanke calls the unborn, the undivided, the undifferentiated. And then he resumed with the assembly. Among all you people here today, there's not a single one who's an unenlightened being. Everyone here is a Buddha. So listen carefully. What you all have from your parents innately is the unborn Buddha mind alone. There's nothing else you have innately. This Buddha mind you have from your parents innately is truly unborn and marvelously illuminating. That which is unborn is the Buddha mind. The Buddha mind is unborn and marvelously illuminating, and what's more, with this unborn, everything is perfectly managed. The actual proof of this unborn, which perfectly manages everything, is that as you're all turned this way, listening to me talk, if out back there's the cawing of crows, the chirping of sparrows, or the rustling of the wind, even though you're not deliberately trying to hear each of these sounds, you recognize and distinguish each one. The voices of the crows and sparrows, the rustling of the wind, you hear them without making any mistake about them, and that's what's called hearing with the unborn. So another word, we could, a rough approximation of this is our fundamental awareness. And this awareness, it's beyond coming and going. This awareness for which we are all equally endowed is ageless. That's why older people will often say, I don't feel old. Now, they don't mean by that they don't feel the aches in their joints and the loss of memory and all the other things that come with aging, the physical body aging. Yes, they would certainly acknowledge that, but there is this other aspect of oneself that feels unaged, beyond aging. I remember when Roshi Kaplow said that to me when he was in his 70s, and he was just really saying in this inquisitive way, kind of wondering way, I don't feel older. I don't feel any particular age. Well, he was speaking from the point of view of this unborn, undying Buddha mind. He continues, well then, while you're all turned this way listening to me talk, you don't mistake the chirp of a sparrow out back for the caw of a crow, the sound of a gong for that of a drum, a man's voice for a woman's, an adult's voice for a child's. You clearly recognize and distinguish each sound you hear without making any mistake. That's the marvelously illuminating dynamic function. Now, of course, we know that we can have makyo, especially during sesshin. One way that manifests is rather common ways. When people are in the Doksan waiting line and they hear the inking bell here in the Zendo and they mistake it for my handbell in Doksan, so they'll strike the bell twice and nothing happens. That's not really what Bankei is talking about. Talking about under normal conditions, we have this ability to differentiate without thinking about it. The thinking function is not necessary to distinguish sounds. Thinking is a secondary thing that will sometimes follow the direct experience, but doesn't need to. So then he says, wondering what's Bankei telling us, all of you are turned this way, intent only on hearing what I'm saying. No one's deliberately trying to hear the various sounds coming from out back. That's why when all of a sudden these sounds appear and you recognize and distinguish them, hearing them without any mistake, you're hearing with the unborn Buddha mind. Nobody here can claim he heard these sounds because he'd made up his mind beforehand to listen for them when they were made. So, in fact, you're listening with the unborn. Everyone who conclusively realizes that what is unborn and marvelously illuminating is truly the Buddha mind, abiding in the unborn Buddha mind, is a living Tathagata from today, forever after. From the standpoint of the unborn, it's only a secondary matter, a peripheral concern, that is the word Buddha. The person of the unborn abides at the source of all Buddhas. The source of all Buddhas. Source is this mind of no mind. It's another word for the unborn. No mind. He says there's nothing more original than the unborn, nothing prior to it. Here's another way that you might experience a fleeting moment of the unborn. Is I've used this before, but just briefly, the first second or two of waking up, sometimes people will, in that first 1 or 2 seconds, they'll be at a complete loss, where there's no self, there's no world. That is, there's no notion of a world or a self. It's just clear, bright, nothing. And then, after a second or two, then, oh yeah, okay, here we are. Okay, we're back. He says there's no question of dying here, so when you abide in the unborn, it's superfluous to speak about the undying too. That's the reason I only talk about the unborn and don't mention the undying. What isn't created can't be destroyed, so since it's unborn, it's obvious it is imperishable without having to mention it. Isn't that so? Don't get bogged down in this. If anyone feels confused about it, it's just meant to throw it out there to land where it might, in somewhere in the mind where it can, maybe if not now, then someday, be understood. What's important is how to access, how to reach this state of the unborn, and that's where our practice comes in. Still skipping through this. There's a lot of repetition. He keeps just saying, just abide in the unborn, just abide in the unborn, just abide in the unborn. Here's one. He says, what everyone has from his parents innately is the Buddha mind alone. So there's, you can understand the unborn as a synonym for Buddha mind, essential nature, original nature. But since your parents themselves fail to realize this, you become deluded too, and then display this delusion in raising your own children. Everyone involved in bringing up children displays every sort of deluded behavior, including stupidity, selfish desire, and the anger of fighting demons. Growing up with deluded people surrounding them, children develop a first-rate set of bad habits, becoming quite proficient and being deluded themselves and turning into unenlightened beings. Originally, when you're born, you're without delusion, but on account of the faults of the people who raise you, someone abiding in the Buddha mind is turned into an unenlightened being. This is something I'm sure you all know from your own experience. Once you'd come into the world, you picked up all different sorts of delusions, which developed into bad habits, so that you couldn't help becoming deluded. That which you didn't pick up from the outside is the unborn Buddha mind. And here, no delusions exist. He says it's because you don't realize the preciousness of Buddha mind that you indulge in self-centeredness, creating delusions that do you harm. Yet those delusions are so precious to you that all of you actually want to become deluded, even at the risk of your own life. Foolish, isn't it? Unable to withstand the base impulses produced by your selfish desires, you become deluded. With all delusions, it's the same. So let's just insert thoughts instead of delusions. That thoughts, most thoughts, arguably all thoughts that we're sitting with, are somehow related, they're wrapped around the delusion of a separate self, the I or the my. And we come to understand that our thoughts, especially in Sesshin, becomes especially clear. Our thoughts are not going to give us anything. They're not our friends. Yet because of a strong habit of continually returning to thoughts about ourself and our pain and our this and our that, we still stick to them, even though they cause us pain, both emotional pain and physical pain. Physical pain gets worse if we're thinking about it. And yet our thoughts keep drawing us back in. We do have some choice. The habit may be strong, but still there is choice each time we notice that the mind has drifted back into thoughts. We do have some measure of freedom as to what we're going to do with our attention. And what we want to do to minimize our suffering is to swing our attention away from the thoughts back to the practice we're working on. It's that simple. Time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four vows. All beings without number, I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to meditate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to meditate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain.